You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. Coming to you live from Studio One, I'm Tige Enright. On today's show, uniting against the Islamic State. As Washington prepares for airstrikes, John Kerry makes a curious admission that ultimately Tehran could take the lead in defeating the democratic world's newest enemy. That's where today's panel discussion kicks off with our guests Shashank Joshi and James Boyes. Here's what we're also talking about today. The polls are open and Scottish voters are deciding whether to go it alone. Stay tuned as we examine the closing stages of the yes and no campaigns. Also ahead, we assess President Xi Jinping's visit to India and debate whether Vladimir Putin's stalking of Ukraine is little more than a power play for his domestic audience. Then, in culture, the world premiere of Sir John Taverner's last major concert work, Flood of Beauty, opens in London later this month. All that, and we'll be reviewing the week in books too. That's Midori House with me, Tige Enright, starting right now. But before all that, the latest world news from Jonathan Wheatley.
Australia has carried out its largest ever counter-terrorism operation after intelligence that Islamic militants were urging supporters to conduct demonstration killings. It's claimed the plan involved snatching someone in Sydney and executing them on camera. 15 people have been arrested after raids in Sydney and Brisbane involving more than 800 police officers. Well, Andrew Colvin is the acting Australian Federal Police Commissioner.
All 25 search warrants were conducted across the suburbs of Sydney that included in excess of 800 officers. Those 800 officers comprised a range of different police skills and capabilities, obviously investigators, forensics experts, specialists, tactical officers, surveillance officers and alike. And as you've seen reported and has been said already, it is the largest operation of its type undertaken in Australia's history.
Meanwhile, Islamic State militants fighting in Iraq and Syria released a video today that they say shows British journalist John Cantley in captivity, saying he will soon reveal facts about the group to counter its portrayal in Western media. The Islamic State, which controls territory in Syria and Iraq, has already beheaded two American journalists and one British aid worker in recent weeks in what it said was reprisal for US airstrikes against it in Iraq. Cantley appears in good health and promises to convey some facts in a series of so-called programs, suggesting there would be further installments. At least 2,630 people have died in the worst outbreak of the Ebola virus in history, which has so far infected at least 5,357 people in West Africa, the World Health Organization said on Thursday. In an update on the epidemic, which is raging through Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia, and has spread into Nigeria and Senegal, the WHO said there were no signs yet of it slowing. Here in the UK, the first volunteer in a trial of a new Ebola vaccine, Ruth Atkins, has been given the injection. It's already been given to 10 people in the US with no signs of serious adverse reactions.
I heard it all on the radio. It made me think this is really sad what is going on out in West Africa. What could I do? I can't go out there and work or anything. So when he was saying about the vaccine, I thought, well, I can help. My little bit of helping would be to participate in the vaccine trial.
It's been a historic day in Scotland with 4 hours to go before polling stations close for a referendum on independence, with the latest survey suggesting a very close result. Turnout is expected to be between 80 and 90%. The result is expected to be confirmed by early Friday morning. At the final rally of the Yes campaign, Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond told supporters that this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and he did promise to respect the outcome of the referendum.
If the vote goes against us, I pledge to accept that result with dignity and with respect for the people. But if the vote is yes, I have no doubt whatsoever that there'll cease to be a no campaign and a yes campaign. There shall be a Team Scotland to take this nation forward.
And finally, four French chefs are requesting a waiver to serve a long-banned delicacy, a small songbird called the otolin that fans, including the late President François Mitterrand, used to devour, bones and all, while wearing a napkin over their heads. The request for the once-a-year waiver is being lodged, among others, by Alain Ducasse, the acclaimed chef with a top three-star rating from the Michelin Gourmet Dining Guide. And that story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Jonathan Wheatley, thanks for that. Was it Ozzy Osbourne ate a bird live on stage or something once?
I'm not sure about that,
or was
actually
it a bat or something?
Yeah, something strange.
Joel Church, our studio manager, is saying I've got the right idea there. Anyway, thank you for that, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv,
to Buenos Aires,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York. And here to take a look back over the day's news so far, I'm joined here in the studio by Shashank Joshi, a senior research fellow at the think tank RUSI. Also James Boyes, who's a senior visiting fellow at King's College London. Two of our regulars, welcome back to the programme. Gents, let's start with the Islamic State. We've just heard plans for US airstrikes against the militants have moved forward. Same time, lawmakers in Washington have given President Obama the green light to arm so-called moderate Syrian rebels to help in the fight. And also a very strange admission from John Kerry before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, saying that in the event that the US fails to contain Islamic State, it could look to Iran to take the lead. And another development in the last hour or so, another propaganda video featuring a British hostage, John Cantley. Let me start by coming to you, Shashank. This video, we hear the captive, the detainee, being used as a mouthpiece, I guess, saying that he will appear in future videos, setting right some wrongs as IS sees it. I mean, is this a change in their propaganda strategy?
I ultimately think Cantley will be beheaded at the end of the day, but I think nothing has done more to bring together an international coalition against the Islamic State to persuade the US public to turn against or turn in favor of military action than these extremely vicious and public beheadings. And so I wonder if the Islamic State is realizing it can get enormous mileage out of these hostages by using people like Cantley to spread their message, and to do so not in the hectoring tones of your traditional jihadist video, but through the mouth of an experienced journalist in a message that is actually quite measured. He says, look, I know I'm a prisoner. I know there's a gun to my head, so you may not believe me, but I'm going to show you some really interesting facts about the Islamic State. But stay tuned till next week. In other words, this is a grotesque parody of a kind of chat show. And I think that it will serve their ends quite effectively.
Okay. The airstrikes, which we're now looking at coming out of the United States, also this vote to allow the arming of moderate Syrian rebels. James Boyes, is this the United States being dragged into another Middle East war, kicking and screaming?
I'm not sure about kicking and screaming, but there's no doubt, as Shashank rightly pointed out, the imagery which has come out, the deaths of just two Americans, is going to have a pivotal impact, I think, upon the direction of policy. It really has forced Obama, I think, to step up. What's fascinating about the vote that came out was that it got a 273 to 156 passing in the House when it was attached to a bill that basically had to be passed. There's no doubt that there's talk about eventually linking this in with perhaps giving backing to the Syrian fighters. Again, that's going to be attached to another piece of legislation which has to be passed if federal workers are to be continue to be paid. So there is domestic politics at play in terms of getting this material through, which I think is the only reason you're seeing real strong bipartisanship at this point. Nobody, either side of the aisle, wants to be doing this. There's a sense that they're going to have to do something just to up the ante, just to keep opponents quiet, I think.
Yeah, one of the senators opposing the resolution, California Democrat Loretta Sanchez, made a point at the hearing. We don't know if sometime down the line they will turn our guns right back on us. And that is always a concern, isn't it?
Well, the CIA has been in charge of a training program on a small covert level for a long time. And some evidence has come to light from congressmen and others saying that the CIA does not have confidence that they can train a rebel force capable of taking on both Assad and the Islamic State. Just to be very clear here, Obama's authorized wants $500 million. This is to train 5,000 rebels. That may be a lot of money per rebel, but don't forget, there are 30,000 Islamic State fighters, according to the CIA's own estimates. There's a numerical problem here, and this problem we've come up with again and again, which is that it's very hard to distinguish moderate groups from non-moderate groups. The 5,000 figure is so small because that's the probably all they can muster up with any confidence. Will that be enough on the ground? We just don't know yet.
Well, I mean, talking of on the ground, I just wonder what is both your assessments of the ability or the beatability of IS from the air or by arming local forces without sending Western troops in to fight them on the ground?
They can be confined to cities relatively easily. They are vulnerable on open terrain as they are stretched out on now. They don't have good air defences. They're very vulnerable to airstrikes. But once they retrench into places like Raqqa in Syria or Mosul and Fallujah, Ramadi in Iraq, it will require good ground forces to exploit US airstrikes if they are to be effective. Who is capable of exploiting those? Well, the Iraqi army does not give us much confidence, neither do the Syrian opposition so far. If they can be trained with $500 million, it'll take months. So we're not going to see results here until next year, in my estimation.
It simply can't be won from the air, there's no doubt about it. I think the Americans, what they're hoping to do is that they can provide an envelope effectively for local forces to pour into that. Who will be doing that? Nobody wants to step up and be doing that ground fighting. I think it's very disappointing that local nations are having to be hectored by the likes of John Kerry to defend make this assault. Nobody from the Western powers, the United States, Britain, is looking at putting serious troops on the ground at this point.
Why did John Kerry say what he said, contemplating failure before?
It's remarkable, isn't it? This is an appearance before the Senate, effectively, and in questioning by Marco Rubio, who most people assume will be a potential candidate for the 2016 Republican ticket, talking about the idea of, well, you know, if we're failing and failing miserably, maybe we might be looking at issues. This after saying that he would not be drawn into hypothetical situations. It really is remarkable.
Did he really say Iran?
He did say Iran, yeah.
This is the same John Kerry, don't forget, who, of course, came to London last year and basically said, oh, well, you know, maybe if the Russians did such and such, and provided an opening which allowed for the dealing with the Syrian chemical weapons issue.
And the danger, isn't it, Shashank, that by talking about bringing in Shia Iranians, you risk alienating the moderate Sunnis who you want to keep on side to defeat IS?
Yes, I mean, Iran is involved in fighting IS. It will be whether or not the Americans want them to or ask them to. But the danger here is, of course, that not only do you alienate those Sunnis who you need to turn against IS, because those Sunnis will think, why should we fight for an Iran-backed government? But more importantly, you also risk alienating those Sunni Arab states who Kerry, as James alluded to, has been desperately trying to corral into this coalition of the reluctant.
Okay, gents, let's come closer to home now. We're going to go to Scotland. It's the only story in town here in the UK. Voters today are having their say about whether Scotland should split from England, Wales and Northern Ireland. And the thing that strikes me about all the coverage we've seen about this in the last week or so, and in the last week since the world's media has really been paying attention, you keep on hearing about it being too close to call, don't you? And it's very tempting. It's a very tempting headline to write.
Yeah.
And save for that one or two opinion polls which put the yes side in the lead, the no side has maintained a kind of a consistent 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 point lead in all the opinion
polls.
And
it's statistically illiterate, I think. And it's an easy mistake to make, because because it looks like a difference of a few percentage points. But of course, the implied probability of that difference is much greater. If no is 52 up, it doesn't mean it's only slightly up. It means there's an 80% chance or something of them winning, given the margin of errors in these various polls. Now, understanding that statistical difference between a difference in polls and a difference in probabilities is difficult, but it's worth stating again and again, with a few exceptions, no is overwhelmingly likely to win.
And given that 15 to 20%, I think, of the electorate remains undecided, those undecideds are far more likely to stick with the status quo, aren't they?
One would imagine so. What's fascinating, I keep hearing all these stories about how David Cameron's job is on the line, whether it goes yes or no. I mean, I've got to give the guy a break. You very rarely hear that said about Alex Salmond. This is a guy whose entire raison d'etre is to get independence. If he can't muster it, surely his job should be on the line.
To be fair, James, I have to say, on the original negotiations, he, of course, wanted a third option, not yes or no. It's Cameron who pushed for that. Salmond wanted a sort of, let's have some more devolution. And of course, if there's a no, he will get that. So I think they win
whatever happens, quite frankly.
Right. And so I can entirely see the case for Salmond's job being on the line here. I think he'll come away, though, in a much better position if he loses than Cameron will if the Prime Minister loses.
Let's play some hypotheticals now, shall we?
Why not?
Let's pretend there is actually a yes vote. All that grandstanding we saw from the no campaign over currency, things like EU membership, things like trade, things like immigration. The reality is, if Scotland votes yes, London will do everything it can to make it as painless a split as possible, won't it?
I don't know. I mean, some of the things that you're talking about there, EU membership, NATO membership, for example, is actually out of Britain's control, for example. And we've heard people from both organisations saying, we don't want any new members for 5 years, for example. So, you know, I think they're clearly trying to sort of inadvertently say, you better not, you know, go out of this programme because you might not get back in effectively.
But if suddenly Vladimir Putin turns his attentions on on an independent Scotland, I think we could presume that London would rise to its defence.
I think this is part of the whole escapade that's been put before the Scots to try and scare the bejeebers out of them not to do that. But quite what happens the day after tomorrow is anybody's guess.
It's worth emphasising, I don't think we would make it easy for them, as you suggest. I think we would want something out of them. We would negotiate. As part of any negotiation, you bargain very hard. I think ultimately Scotland has to join the EU, of course. It has to join NATO. I mean, any other solution is just militarily mad.
And it wants to.
Integrated air defence.
Yeah.
But for our acquiescence in that, I can see us pushing for a lot. For example, insisting that our nuclear submarines can remain in Scotland for much longer than 2020, as the Scots want, insisting that Scotland either gives up fiscal powers or accepts non-currency union, all of these things. So those core issues, yes, Scotland will get its way, but we will drive a hard bargain. That will be a bitter, bitter process.
Let's talk more about, the more likely outcome, that being that it is a no vote. But if it is a slim no vote, has this question gone away? I mean, this is a once-in-a-lifetime,
you'd hope so.
It's never really been asked before,
yeah,
has it?
Absolutely. I mean, not without someone's head getting cut off many, many years ago, I suppose. But, I mean, you've got to wonder, this is the great debate, isn't it? If it goes no, and the union continues, will Salmond and the Scottish Nationalists just keep coming back to the table again and again and again and saying, look how slim it was? I honestly think that the Nationalists will get so much out of this deal, quite frankly, if they remain part of the union, that, as we were alluding to before, it's a win-win scenario. They either get their independence and they go the way they want to go, or they're going to get so much extractions of promises and this, that and the other, which so many people have been criticising in recent days, that, quite frankly, you know, it's as good as, almost. And the only people who will be unhappy at the end of it will be probably Salmond and Sir Sean Connery, whichever golf course is on in sunny Spain somewhere.
And that's what we see in Canada, of course. Nationalists use concessions they've gained after a referendum to come back for more.
Absolutely.
And I think that given the anger within the Tory party about the devolution already promised, put on the table and subsidising, so, you know, indolent Scots, etc., any real concessions to Scotland after no will have to be coupled with a promise of, we're not coming back to this for another 50 years or something.
Indeed, chaps. There, we'll have to leave it for this part of our news review. In the meantime, you're listening to Midori House. I'm Tadhg Enright, joined by Shashank Joshi and James Boyes. When we return, we'll continue our review of the day's news, discussing Xi Jinping's visit to India. We'll also postulate some big theories about Vladimir Putin's strategy in Ukraine. Do stay with us.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Let's move our discussion on now to relations between China and India. The Chinese president, Xi Jinping, is in India for a three-day visit. And all the while, you have this bizarre situation where he's playing nice-nice with Mr. Modi. Meanwhile, both countries' troops are facing off along a disputed frontier between the two countries.
It's a bizarre situation, and it shows you China's economic heft means there's interaction taking place on one level, and Japan, South Korea, Australia, India are all lining up at China's door to get a slice of this, these billions of investment funds they need, whilst, of course, China is pushing its weight around Asia, and that includes not just the South China Sea, as we know quite well, the Pacific. It includes India's land border, one of the few land border disputes China has left. You know, this is a serious situation. There are about hundreds of PLA troops 5 kilometers into Indian claimed territory. There's a big undelineated border here, heli-dropping supplies, and the president is in Delhi. It shows you how constrained India's options are. Their way of dealing with this is to ignore the border incursion and just sort of have smiley, happy, bloviating communiques with each other. But at the end of the day, this is a serious concern for Indian elites.
James Boyce, if you were Narendra Modi's advisor,
thank God I'm not.
What would you be telling him to say right now?
It's the economy, stupid.
Indeed, and it does look that way, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it's what it's all about, ultimately. I mean, we can dress this up one way or the other, but this is about finance. And there is an extent to which, you know, all of the rebets are off. And the idea that, as Shashank rightly pointed out, you know, China's heft is so great that it can throw its weight around and we can almost ignore this. You know, this is almost like, it's an untold story. There's so little focus upon this here in Western Europe. You know, if you were to sort of explain this in terms of the overall parameters, people would think we were talking about Russia and Ukraine in terms of border intervention, and the fact that we're not, and we're talking about, you know, the world's largest democracy, India, you know, almost on the verge of conflict with the world's largest, second largest economy, soon to be the largest economy, I'm quite sure. You know, it really gives you pause for thought about the direction of policy in the near future and the lack of attention upon such a vital part of the world.
But this is a 1914 question as well, isn't it? How do those economic and political logics interact with each other? Do they clash into each other? We assume, look, trade between Japan and China is so huge that they would be deterred in any crisis. And we assume the same thing, of course, of India, of South Korea, of Australia. But there are balancing coalitions forming. We know India, for example, Modi was in Japan a few weeks ago. Tony Abbott, the Australian premier, was in Delhi a few weeks ago. India is hedging its bet. And at some point, will these countries judge a political issue, a border dispute here, a maritime clash here? Well, it's just too big to ignore for economic reasons.
You characterise it, Shashank, as India hedging its bets, but is it more a case of India playing Japan off China?
Well, I think they're both playing each other off. Who's playing who off here? I mean, of course, Shinzo Abe wants India to be a bigger part of Asia. He wants India to join in to a balancing coalition. Japan is selling India amphibious boats. Big deal. This is a big deal. Japan does not sell military kit. It's now doing so to India. India is the one who's wary of getting dragged into this. I would say it's much more Japan trying to pull India on into its corner. But you have these uneasy coalitions. And of course, no one wants to admit what they're doing, which is balancing against China. No one talks about China. I'm trying to think of a suitable anthropomorphic metaphor here without getting orientalist here to panda the room.
You know, the two leaders didn't ignore the border question. They said they wanted to resolve their differences. They didn't actually say that they had achieved anything towards resolving their differences.
They say that every year.
And one would suggest indeed that they haven't, because this is a dispute which has been going on for a generation.
At least,
and they seem to be quite happy to leave it there, festering.
And guess what? The Dalai Lama is right slap bang in the middle of it because of a 1959 FBI decision with regard to asylum. So there's all sorts of cultural heritage, political, economic issues at stake here. And, you know, it will be fascinating to see how this does eventually play out, if indeed it does.
On the one hand, the Indians will say, we're not going to get rid of the Dalai Lama. He's our honoured guest, you know, too bad Chinese. On the other hand, they've been stopping Chinese protesters from getting near Xi in Delhi. So it's this awkward, awkward balance for them.
Indeed. Let's again come closer to home and talk about Vladimir Putin and Ukraine. A couple of news lines out of that situation. We've got the Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko. He's in Washington while at home. Concessions of autonomy being made to those Russian-leaning parts in the east of the country. That move being welcomed by Moscow. And although, you know, we see this ceasefire holding, effectively, you know, this stealth invasion of Ukraine by Russia is still underway. And quite an interesting opinion piece by the very well-regarded Russian writer Mikhail Shishkin, theorising that kind of Putin is managing to resurrect the old Soviet spirit and is waging a stealth war against the West. And it's quite alarming, I suppose, to hear these unconfirmed, I suppose, reports that Putin has allegedly threatened he can have troops not only in Kiev, but in several EU capitals in Eastern Europe within 2 days. Did these words actually come out of his mouth, do you think?
Well, they've not denied it. The fascinating thing about this was that report came out about the idea of being in Kiev, and it was unsubstantiated. Then it was put to the Kremlin and they refused to refute it effectively. What is, I think, fascinating is this opinion piece that the Guardian have put out. It's fascinating, but is it really news? I mean, this idea that Putin wants to extend to almost an old-style Soviet sphere of influence, it's not exactly groundbreaking. I always think of Dick Cheney's retort, obviously, about looking into Putin's eyes, and whereas Bush claimed he could read his soul, Putin said he saw KGB, KGB, KGB. And I think that's, you know, wise to remember. You know, you look at this, you look at what Putin's doing, his whole approach to this is fascinating in terms of what he's doing. But what isn't he doing? You know, how much entrenched into Crimea, Ukraine, is he getting? Is he getting bogged down? Is it progressing the way he would have liked? There's no doubt, I think, that the fact that the whole ISIS issue has come along and diverted attention away from that is for his benefit, quite frankly. And but what you don't necessarily see, I think, and I know people who've been over to Kiev quite recently and saying that, you know, there is an extent to which within Kiev, it's quite a sense of normality. In other parts of the region, in the more eastern territory, it's very, very different, perhaps. But this idea, I think, of, you know, moving into Eastern European countries above and beyond that, I think we're moving into, you know, fantasy world if we're not careful at this point. I don't think Putin, whatever one thinks of him, wants to start a land war between the West on the European continent.
But why did he say it? And the reason is psychological warfare. He enjoys the appearance of strength, the Russian status. He knows that it projects Russia as a global power, and he knows that it puts NATO completely on the back foot and plays well at home.
Why isn't he pushing harder? I mean, if he's playing what is in effect a game of chicken with the West, and it does kind of appear like he's winning because the West has done largely nothing, why isn't he pushing harder?
Where do you push? You know, the other apparently weak points are all protected by NATO's collective security guarantee. Putin is not an idiot, of course. He understands that an attack on a NATO member is an entirely different proposition
to an
attack on
Ukraine. I'm talking
about
Eastern Ukraine here. I mean, he strolled into Crimea and took it within the space of less than a fortnight.
Well, because his entire position depends, of course, on maintaining the fiction that these are purely indigenous separatist rebels, not Russian forces. Therefore, the level of support he can offer has to remain within certain boundaries. But tactically, what does he want? Well, he wants a land bridge to Crimea, possibly to make sure Donetsk and Lugansk don't fall. He's achieved these objectives. He doesn't want anything else. He doesn't want to go to Kiev. He doesn't want Kiev.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I mean, you know, as we were saying before and many times on this show, you start moving into NATO territories and all of a sudden you risk triggering Article 5, which, of course, has only been done once before after 9/11. Nobody within NATO is angling for a war. Putin, whatever one thinks of him, isn't angling for a war with NATO. He wants what he wants. He wants to get it with as little bloodshed as possible, and at this rate, he's getting it.
And what do you read into the strategy of Kiev granting some, or making some promises of autonomy to those parts of the east?
It's the practical response to the fact that they understand they are being abandoned to their fate, that Western powers are giving them a little bit of military support here, a little bit of economic support there, some, you know, friendship at the NATO summit, an arm around Poroshenko, but nothing else. He has to negotiate with the realities on the ground. And that is, separatist forces cannot be defeated as long as Russia backs them.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I mean, this idea that, you know, what are you going to do in their situation? It's nice to say that at least there is a country who does have a strategy, which is more than a lot of nations in the West appear to have at this point.
Gents, there we'll leave it. James Boyce, Shashank Joshi, thank you very much for joining us here, as ever, on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио, Monocle 24 です.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the next half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our man in Canada. Plenty of culture to be talked about too. Before we get started on all of that though, Jonathan Weekly has the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. Australia has carried out its largest ever counter-terrorism operation after intelligence that Islamic militants were urging supporters to conduct demonstration killings. It's claimed the plan involves snatching someone in Sydney and executing them on camera. Meanwhile, Islamic State militants fighting in Iraq and Syria have released a video today that they say shows the British journalist John Cantley in captivity, saying he will soon reveal facts about the group to counter its portrayal in Western media. At least 2,630 people have died in the worst outbreak of the Ebola virus in history, which has so far infected at least 5,357 people in West Africa, the World Health Organization said today. And it's been a historic day in Scotland, with just 3.5 hours to go before polling stations close for a referendum on independence, with the latest survey suggesting a very close result. Turnout is expected to be between 80 and 90% of Scottish voters. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much for that. Kicking off the second half of Midori House here, live on Monocle 24, with the time at 21.31 in Moscow. It's 18.31 here in London, 14.31 in Rio de Janeiro. We're going to check in now with one of our correspondents and our bureaus all over the world. Today we're going to Canada, where Chris Frey joins us from our bureau in Toronto. Welcome back to Midori House, Chris. People there still chewing, if you'll pardon the pun, over this deal by Burger King to buy Tim Hortons.
Yeah, well, it's a deal I think that is causing more consternation in the U.S. I mean, just to recap, last month, Burger King, the fast food chain, said it would be buying the Canadian coffee and food chain Tim Hortons for about $12.5 billion. And although Burger King is the one in the driver's seat of the relationship, as part of the deal, Burger King said it will move its headquarters to Canada. And there it will enjoy a considerably lower corporate tax rate than in the U.S. And the move has drawn fire from President Obama and other politicians who've now tried to make it a campaign issue there, with the midterms coming. I believe Obama directly referred to it as it's wrong. He said, I don't care if it's legal, it's wrong. And he called companies like Burger King corporate deserters. Meanwhile, for Canada, we have our industry minister was in the U.S. yesterday, and he was crowing somewhat over Burger King's decision and raised the possibility of more big-name U.S. firms choosing to move north, not just for the lower corporate tax rate, although that's the big incentive, I believe, but also the number of free trade treaties that Canada now has with other countries, including now the European Union, as another attractive feature for moving here.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we just had the OECD publishing its assessment on how to tackle this problem of tax avoidance by big multinational firms. Countries here in Europe, like Ireland, like the Netherlands, all, you know, saying that they want to help clamp down on it, even though they are the beneficiaries of it. They're treading a delicate line. And yet here we have the Canadian industry minister heading south of the border and saying, yeah, come on back up north across the border, guys.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know how effective this move will be. There's a few other angles to the situation, I guess. I mean, obviously, Canada is going to have its own federal election a year from now. I don't know that corporate tax rates will change dramatically, but there's obviously other features to doing business in the country that, you know, differ from the U.S. I guess we'll see how this plays out in the U.S. in terms of the optics of companies moving. But, you know, if the economics makes sense, I don't know if Canada is always going to be the most central place. I think there's probably European countries or, for example, London that may offer more attractive qualities.
Talking of elections, and one very close to you, the Toronto mayoral election, poor Rob Ford has had to pull out because of his ill health. Have you got a status update for us?
Yes. Well, as you might know, last Friday, and this was only moments before the 2 o'clock filing deadline, Ford removed his name from the ballot for mayor days before it was revealed that a tumor had been found in his stomach. Yesterday, the results came back and the doctors said that he has a malignant tumor in his stomach, which has been identified as liposarcoma. It's a rare and aggressive form of cancer. And he'll begin chemotherapy this week for treatment. It needs to be said, though, that at that 2 o'clock deadline, though Ford withdrew his name for mayor, there was a bit of a switcheroo involved. He then said he would be running again for his old council seat and that his brother Doug Ford would be running in his stead for mayor, so that there would still be, let's say, a Ford concept on the mayoral ballot. And so while people, I guess, took it in stride in some ways, I think, you know, in others, I think if we took a step back, it's, you know, there's this presumptuousness that the Fords again display that somehow they're entitled to holding public office and presiding over this city. Doug, so far, even though he hasn't begun campaigning yet, it looks like that Rob's support has shifted Doug's way, which puts him in second place behind, or tied for second, about 12 points behind, 12 percentage points behind the leader. So we'll, you know, we have another month and a half for a lot to unravel.
Yeah, talk to us more about the support for the Ford camp. You know, this whole affair, if you want to call it that, has been dragging on for quite some time. Is it waning? And is Doug half the man, if you want to put it that way, that his brother is? I mean, in terms of mayoral candidates, he probably couldn't get much worse than his brother.
Yeah, and that's the odd thing. This may sound strange to an international audience, but for all that people know about Rob Ford, but Doug is actually much less likable than Rob. Rob, for all his faults, which to some find endearing, does have his, he is a consummate retail politician. Even when he's been in his bedside the past week, you know, and I believe it when they say he's, you know, making phone calls around the clock, trying to fix people's potholes and stuff. That's how he made his name as a city councilor for 10 years.
He gets things done.
He gets things done, but on that molecular level, that, you know, really isn't the mayor's job. And that's been, if you want to give a serious assessment of his performance outside of the circus, I mean, you merely need to point to that on the big issues like transit, this city has not moved forward. It's stalled. And he just keeps tinkering around the edges. So Rob Ford, in terms of his support, it's not growing. I mean, it's may seem remarkable, but he still captures around 20 to 25% of the vote in this city, people who sympathize with him intensely and yet, you know, aren't, you know, maybe a little bit bothered by the scandals around him, but ultimately identify with him on a certain level and his sort of, you know, cut the gravy train, the sort of keep my taxes low policy. His brother is a bit more of a bully. He doesn't have the same experience and personal touch at council. I think when Rob Ford became mayor and Doug was a councillor, the interesting thing was that everybody thought that Doug would be a restraining influence on his brother, that Doug was the smart one. When in fact, you know, Doug may be the smart one, but he's not the strategic one or the tactical one. It's been Doug more often who's floated these lame, ludicrous ideas like building a monorail on the waterfront or a giant Ferris wheel that just sort of come out of nowhere and is very bad at building consensus and is the classic bully type when you see the sort of accusations he goes out in public with.
And talking of another election, the federal election, one in which all Canadians will obviously be interested, although I think most Canadians are probably quite interested in Rob Ford and Toronto mayoral race as well. But even though it's next year, there's already a lot of anticipation for it.
Well, as the next session of Parliament kicked off this week, everybody's looking at it as sort of the beginning of a 400-day campaign. I mean, we now have campaigns that feel almost as long as those in the U.S. for president, but at least they have a primary process, and whereas we're stuck with the same characters, you know, throughout for the whole year, and thus we have fewer surprises. You know, the stage has been set. I think, Stephen Harper has been the prime minister for about a decade now. He's looking fatigued. fatigued. A lot of his veteran ministers are falling off around him. He's looked never looked, I think, more vulnerable, although he still has a majority government. For the last 18 months, Justin Trudeau, his primary adversary, I'd say, the leader of the Liberal Party, has been leading in the polls for 18 months, unbroken. And that hasn't happened at any other time during Harper's reign. Of course, they treat Trudeau as a lightweight. I don't know how afraid the Conservatives are. They've gone to some strange extremes this past summer to paint Trudeau as one way or another. Harper has a very big war chest. They're fantastic fundraisers. But there's something about Trudeau that's gotten under Harper's skin, and it'll be interesting to see how the next year unfolds.
But even I see some of those in Harper's kind of conservative support base, moderates, turning against him. Why is that?
Yeah, well, he's an ideologue. And I think whether it's in foreign policy or in his the way he manages government, his managerial style, he's you know, everything is centralized in his office. His ministers have very little say over what it is, what policy they're advancing. There's been what's been called a war on science, you know, not ministers, but scientists who either work for the government or working on studies that this government has financed that have been stifled, especially when it comes to their findings on climate change. There's just this air of Nixonian paranoia at this stage that surrounds this government, whether it's the science community or whether it's his political adversaries or even people in the middle. Classic case is his former justice minister when he tried to introduce a bill that targeted child pornographers and used the internet as a way to sort of create a wedge. If you didn't support this bill, which contained all sorts of provisions that had nothing to do with child pornography, it was like, you're either with us or you're with the child pornographers. And I think it's that style of governance and politicking that's even alienating people who would otherwise be in his base.
Something we're sure to be coming back again to closer to election time. Chris Frey joining us from our Toronto Bureau. Thank you very much for that. Up next, we're going on a transcendental musical journey.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. I'm Ty Genwright. Now, later this month, London's Barbican Centre is the venue for the world premiere of the last major work of the composer Sir John Taverner. The Bittan Sinfonia will perform Flood of Beauty, based on a Sanskrit poem by the 9th century philosopher and poet Sankara. Now, many of Taverner's works were based on his explorations of religions, Christianity, Islam, Judaism. Well, the Flood of Beauty is said to be an attempt to show the rapture and bliss of the divine being through Hinduism. In a moment, I'll be talking to Chris Sharp from The Barbican, who'll be telling us more about the show. But first, let's listen to a short clip of Sir John Taverner's music to give you a sense of what you might be hearing. So Chris Sharp from The Barbican is here with us. The show, Flood of Beauty, none of the music has been recorded, so we can't play you any. Why has it taken so long for this performance to actually happen?
Well, that's a good question. To give you a bit of background, we'd been talking about doing something with Taverner at this time, because it would have been his 70th birthday year. So this is a conversation that had been going on for a while, and we'd actually been in discussion with him about him potentially curating a concert which would combine music from around the world with some of his own music to reflect his kind of global inspiration. And then, of course, the sad news came last year that he had died. And so that we thought that was that. But then we got a call from his music publisher, Music Sales, Chester Music, who said, we've got this piece that he wrote in around about 2008. It's a full evening-length piece. It's never been performed. Would you be interested? And so, of course, we were interested. To answer the question why it hadn't been performed, I think the answer is that it's a bit complicated for various reasons, which would probably take me a long time to go into. But it's a complex work for orchestra and choir and soloists. It includes Indian sitar and percussion, and the performers have to be spread around the auditorium, so
yeah,
the audience are in the middle.
Explain that for us in a little bit more detail. Are you saying that you could potentially be sitting beside a performer if you're a ticket holder for one of these gigs?
And probably not directly alongside, no, because we have a careful system of seat holds to kind of separate the performers and the artists. But broadly speaking, there was this really lovely note that Taverner wrote as a kind of synopsis of the piece, where he had this phrase, which is the kind of very Taverner-esque phrase, where he says, "I want the audience to be surrounded by bliss and beauty." So the idea is that without any kind of electronic enhancement or PA system, he wants the audience to be at the centre of this sound world. And so to achieve that, we obviously have some of the musical instruments, some of the performers on the stage, but we also have them up in the balcony and on either side of the circle. So we're selling tickets to the central sections of the hall, and you will hear music coming at you from all sides.
And is that precedented? I mean, have other composers done stuff like that?
I mean, yeah, quite a few kind of contemporary composers like to mess around with kind of these spatial concepts. But I think in Taverner's approach, it's absolutely driven by this mystical impulse rather than a kind of technical one. So he really wants to create this immersive experience. And that's what's different about the way that he goes about it, I think.
Let's just listen to another extract of another of Sir John Taverner's works. This is called The Protecting Veil. Chris Sharp from the Barbican is still with us. Chris, is it difficult to arrange a performance like this without the composer? Talk to us about the challenges there.
Well, in a sense, the composer is there because he wrote very, very detailed notes in his manuscript score for the piece about how it should be performed, down to he actually rather beautifully includes the text in Sanskrit, and he produces a little lexicon of correct vowel pronunciations in Sanskrit so that the singers know their vowel sounds. So, he's guiding us in lots of ways, but in other ways, we've had to fit it to our space. I think he probably imagined this being performed in a huge Greek basilica or something like that, and we're a concert hall, so there's been lots of kind of technical challenges around that. And actually, it's just a very, very complicated piece of music.
Okay. And this is part of what you guys are calling your Transcender series. What other performances are forming part of this series?
Yeah, so Transcender is our attempt to kind of, how can I put it, kind of to write about, to do shows around kind of sacred music, devotional music, and music that seeks to kind of remove the individual, the listener, from the everyday and take them to another level. And we've been doing this for about, this is actually the sixth year that we've been doing this series. And we kind of explore lots of music from different faiths, from different parts of the world. And we kind of throw in the odd kind of curveball as well with, you know, electronic music, trance music in that sense, and cosmic jazz, astral jazz, all kinds of things that are all basically designed to take you out of yourself. So it's a slightly clumsy phrase, but we think we've been doing it for long enough to know what we mean by it, even if nobody else does. So we haven't actually done a kind of big orchestral kind of quasi-classical piece like Taverner in Transcender before. It's mostly been about global music, but it's such an obvious fit because of his global influences.
Okay, and you can hear that, Sir John Taverner's A Flood of Beauty, on the 28th of September at the Barbican Centre here in London. Chris Sharp from the Barbican, thank you very much for coming in to talk
to
us. It's time now for a little bit of music of our own. While our brothers and sisters north of the border here in Britain are going to the polls today, let's listen to some Scottish music with a somewhat appropriate title. Here is Franz Ferdinand with You Are the Reason I'm Leaving. Scottish musicians Franz Ferdinand there with their 2009 song You're the Reason I'm Leaving. Not sure that was written with the independence referendum in mind, but hey, it's a little bit of mischief for us to play in a day like today. You're with Midori House. We'll be right back. time now to review some of our, well, as we usually do, we review the best, sometimes the worst of the worlds of TV, cinema, theatre, books and more. It's books today. We're talking to Alexander Starrett, literary critic for TLS, among other publications. Welcome back to Midori House, Alex.
Thanks.
Your first book you've picked out for us, Hack Attack by Nick Davies, who arguably was the man behind the revelation of phone hacking here in the UK by journalists.
Well, I think not just arguably. He did all the legwork. It took him 5 years of research and investigation and digging to get all the information about the hacking at the News for the World out into the public domain. And this book is essentially the story of that, of those 5 years and the things that he found out along the way.
What have we learned in this book that I suppose didn't come out throughout all the coverage of the hacking affair?
The thing that's incredible about it is the way he captures the atmosphere of the newsroom in these places, specifically the News of the World, and the sheer extent of what was going on there. For example, at one point they believed that David Blunkett, when he was Home Secretary, was having an affair with an estate agent. It turned out he wasn't. But in order to find out, they hacked his voicemail. You know, he was the Home Secretary at the time. Hers, her mother, her father, her cousin, her brother, her osteopath, in total about 20 people. And what you get in this book is the kind of the febrile intensity, the just kill anyone, do anything, throw everything overboard kind of madness.
The whole thing about the whole hacking affair is just how easy it was. I mean, we all remember what it was like when we had, well, most of us have had mobile phones now for about the last 10 or 15 years. And you get your new phone and you're logging into your voicemail from another phone. And if you haven't gone in and changed your password, it was 0000. And it's hardly surprising that some journalists, you know, whatever about the ethics of it, it's hardly surprising some went down that road because it was so easy.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people weren't surprised. And one of the other things that comes out in this book is how slow the police were to do anything about it. And I think that's related to this because I think the police essentially thought it was not that big of a deal, which seems shocking now because of some of the revelations, particularly with Millie Dowler. And these more serious cases. But when it's just the newspapers finding out about people's love lives or who's cheated on
who. Titillations. It's quite interesting as well. I believe this book also reveals how Nick Davies first, you know, found out about the story. He said he was contacted by anonymous sources within Murdoch's newspapers here who obviously thought, this is wrong. There were some people with a conscience there.
I'm not so sure. I mean, I think that's part of this.
They didn't have to raise a flag for no reason unless they were looking for a bit of a kickback themselves.
Well, I think that organization made a lot of enemies.
Right.
I'm not sure that all those people had their hands clean themselves.
Yeah. Well, they were just probably pushed too far by the ginger-haired one and decided to get some revenge, perhaps. Rebecca Brooks, I'm talking about there, the former chief executive of News International and editor of the News of the World. Let's move on. Your next book, Stone Mattress, is a collection of short stories by Margaret Atwood. Why have you picked that out for us?
Well, because Margaret Atwood's such an interesting writer, usually. Although, and I think this is a particularly interesting book of hers, because she's done something that she doesn't usually do. You know, usually when you think of a Margaret Atwood book, you think this is going to be well-written, well-put-together, intelligent, but essentially a bit like a lecture. You know, Margaret Atwood is going to tell me why I'm wrong about the environment or about gender relations. And in this book, she doesn't do that. It seems much more personal in tone.
Did someone tell her to get less preachy?
She's got, I think so. I mean, incredibly, perhaps someone has, but she seems to have listened. I mean, she's been doing her thing for, I suppose, 40 or 50 years. And now she's written this quite different book, which is all about...
And what topics is she touching on in it?
Well, you know, it's short stories, so they're all different. But more than half of them, fully more than half, are about aging literary figures coming to terms with the vexed questions of their youth.
Okay. More short stories in your last book, Law of Desire by Andrei Blatnik.
Yeah, it sounds like it should have something to do with rules of attraction, but nothing whatsoever. He's a Slovenian and one of the biggest writers in Slovenia. What makes this book interesting is that he writes his best stories very much in the mould of Raymond Carver, except sort of more generously, less stark, less brutally. So, for example, in one of them, a man walks in to find his wife in bed with his best friend. He pulls out a gun. We expect everything's going to go terribly wrong. But instead, it kind of resolves away from climax. It resolves to a lower degree of intensity. He accidentally shoots not himself or the friend, but the television. And then they have a joke about it. They go down the pub. They talk it out. You know, it's lovely to see something that doesn't go for
less
the
dramatic
hit.
Drama. Yeah,
exactly.
Quite interesting. You point out that he's a Slovenian. His work has been translated into more than 20 languages. And I always wonder if authors like that work with their translators to make sure that the same story, the same nuanced story, is getting told.
Well, I mean, as it happens, I do know an eminent Slovenian poet who does travel with his translator for exactly that reason. And then, I mean, his English is very good, but he checks over all the English translations as well. And I think perhaps in poetry, more so than in fiction, it's a question of tone, of word painting, perhaps. And yeah, I think it's crucial.
Okay. Alexander Starrett, literary critic for TLS, among others. Thank you, as ever, for joining us here on Midori House. And that brings us to the end of our programme today. Thanks in particular go to our special guests with their review of the day's news, Shashank Joshi from the think tank RUSI, also the US political historian James Boyce. Thanks to our producer too, Isabel Kayser. The show was also researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager, pushing the buttons, Joel Church. Next up, after the news headlines, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And then there's more current affairs at 2200 hours tonight if you're listening in London. The Monocle Daily will be brought to you by Nancy Durham and Georgina Godwin. Midori House will be back, though, at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for now, from me, Tighe Enright, it's goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
London. Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.